Greetings, sisters, and welcome to the Wild Mystic Woman podcast, an interview series of powerful conversations with modern mystics, wild women, soulful entrepreneurs, and divine feminine leaders. I'm your host, Leila Saad, and I'm a writer and mentor for spiritual women doing sacred work. In each episode, we hold intimate and holy conversations about the heroine's journey, the spiritual entrepreneurial journey, and what it means to be a wild mystic woman. Today, we are speaking to Mickey DeVivo. Mickey is a writer and a mom, a truth teller, and a story witnesser. She holds spaces where it's okay to be who you are and asks questions that open a new way of seeing oneself and one's family. I'm really excited to have Mickey on the show because as soon as we came into each other's radars, I was really attracted to her work, her energy, the way that she speaks about parenting, storytelling, the real messiness of it all, the beauty, the challenges, and how she brings to light and holds space for conversations around an area which can be very tender for those of us who are parents. And as a writer, you know, I'm always excited to speak with fellow writers. So I'm really excited to have conversations around that today. So welcome to the show, Mickey.
Oh, hi. I'm so excited.
We are both really excited, you guys. Like, we were messaging each other before we came. I was like, I'm really excited for today's conversation because we will get into this during the conversation. But basically, I feel that a conversation that I had with Mickey a couple of weeks ago, I think, Mickey, was really pivotal for me as a writer. And help me to realize that I could really be a writer in my own way. And I think that's a huge part of the magic that you bring, is that when it comes to parenting, when it comes to entrepreneurship, when it comes to writing, when it comes to creating anything, your message is about doing it your way and not comparing yourself to others. And so I think that's a huge part of my message, but I'm glad that I had you to reflect that back to me. It was very, very powerful.
Thank you so much. That was a really amazing conversation, and it means a lot to know that by being together like that, that's helpful. I think that's what it's about for me. It's like when we get to be really together with people, like really who we are with people, that's where the magic is, and that's where the healing is. And I really think we're all just walking each other home. And I don't think any of us does this without fortification. Our friend Kelly's word is without that fortification, without that community, without being when we can hold and see each other and reflect those things back to each other, that's what it's about for me. It was really special for me too.
Yeah, thank you. So I know we're going to be speaking about a lot of things today. We're going to speak about parenting and
all the things.
Yes, creative work and everything. But I want to start out by asking you, Mickey, what do you most love about being a wild mystic woman?
I love that just exists, like that's even a possibility. I just haven't thought about this before we talked, even though I know this is a question you ask everybody, but I just was kind of wanting to be in the moment with it.
Yeah.
I think it's legacy. I think like wild mystic woman, like each one of those pieces names like our legacy, our that's been left to us, like our ancestry. And I think there's a lot in the dominant culture that makes money and power by dividing us from those things. And so by like just simply, it's not simple, but, you know, just allowing that to be is countercultural in a really positive, powerful way. And it's also really scary because the dominant narrative kind of says wildness is scary, mysticism can't be trusted, women are all the things that, you know, anybody who's woman or woman identifying, like, there's just so many layers of that. So it's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that are also still unfolding for me too, of accepting that is, you know, I say it's birthright, but then accepting that it's birthright is another level of practice. Yeah. So I've always, it's been interesting to think about my relationship to wildness and women and being feminine. I remember being a really young age and deciding I wasn't going to perform that role. So I didn't shave. I think I started shaving my armpits when I was 18 and my legs when I was 21. Like, I didn't shave. I don't wear makeup. I don't do many of the things that are performative of that. But I also present in a way that is, I mean, I'm a white, blonde, green-eyed, you know, fairly thinnish woman, right? So then there's also the fact that, like, it was easy for me to quote unquote pass without having to do that stuff. But I just knew, so I have a very interesting relationship with my femininity because there was part of me that saw that as bad or saw that as weakness or saw that as less than, saw it as frivolous or stupid. And so in some ways, not performing that is a helpful choice. And in some ways, not doing those things, not embracing those things has been a painful choice. Mm. So it's fascinating. And it's fascinating watching my daughter grapple with that too, because we're much more explicit about all of those things with her than my parents were with me. Not in any criticism way. I just think that's, you know, like a generational thing that's happening now. Mm. So yeah, there's a lot of layers.
There are a lot of layers. Yeah.
Yeah, that I'm still unfolding and I was just watching a TED Talk yesterday that I'll give you the link to so you can refer to it about she was cisgendered but her sexuality was queer, so she was talking about wearing her femininity as armor. And I know our friend Renee talks about, like, adornment as armor. And so those things are really interesting to think about how femininity is also power and strength and, when, like, it is a source of power that I can let myself tap into that I might not have always done so because I let myself believe that it was unworthy or less than.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't know. That's such a...
I love this so much. I love it so much though, Mickey, because I know that in conversations I've had with women in my community, when we're exploring, and certainly for myself as well, when each of us is exploring this, what does it actually mean to be a wild mystic woman? And what are the parts that I rejected? And what are the parts that I wore because I thought society wanted me to act that way? And what are the parts that I'm rediscovering and realizing I can do them in my own completely unique way? There's so many layers to it. And this is why I love asking this question, because I think a lot of times in the spiritual business realm, there is a what comes across as the norm of what a spiritual entrepreneur looks like or what a priestess looks like, there's a certain look and there's a certain feel and there's a certain energy. And I don't fit into those things. And
yeah, but anybody seeing a picture of you when you're really looking at the camera, you, there's no doubt. Like, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. So, I'm not trying to contradict you, but also.
Well, it's funny because what I do when I take those selfies, when I take those pictures, is I'm tuning into what that means for me. So I remember when I first got started in this area of work, because, you know, I had a previous business before for like 2 years that wasn't very spiritual. It was very soulful, but it wasn't spiritual. And I remember being my soul kind of bringing me into this area of work, and for a long time feeling like, well, I can't call myself that because I don't have the look and I don't speak in that way, or, you know, I don't live in that side of the world even. And feeling like, where do I fit? And what Wild Mystic Woman, the business, the brand, the energy, what I call Wild Mystic Woman, my higher self, that's her name. And what she has shown me is that it really is what it is for you. So if you can tune into the power of what that is, that, if that means shaving, shave. If that means don't shave, don't shave. If it means, like, for me, what really makes me feel tuned into that is like bold lipstick, right? Yeah. But then sometimes it's also like no makeup, nothing on, and just showing my raw, true form. And what I am really interested in cultivating is a new, or a, it's like an alternative, you know, like a normalized vision of what this work can look like, and that you don't have to look a certain way or talk a certain way, or your website look like you're, you know, in a field wearing all white clothing and stretching your arms up to the sky. Not that there's anything wrong with any of that, but that it doesn't all have to look like that if that's not your tempo, like that's not your energy. And what I love also about being a Wild Mystic Woman is that we're constantly discovering the different layers of what that all means. And so, you know, this month it might look a certain way, next month it might look different. And I think it has to be it is an identity in that there are words that kind of identify what it is, right? Wild Mystic Woman. And at the same time, that has to be freedom. Otherwise, it's just another box. Yeah.
I love that so much. It reminded me of, so I have, in grad school, I studied educational theater. And so we took a women in theater class. One of the things that I noticed back then is that there's a difference between a masculine way of telling stories and a feminine way of telling stories. Whereas, so a masculine way of storytelling was, you know, a single character focus, very, very linear, with a very clear, like, you know, rising action, climax, denouement, right?
Right.
And that the women writers were telling stories from multiple perspectives, from a fluidity of timelines, open-ended endings, and that was not bad. That was another way of working, that a defining characteristic of the feminine aspect is that freedom, like you were saying, comes from the fluidity of today it's this and tomorrow it's that and next week it could be something else, and that fluidity and that multiplicity wasn't a flaw, it was a feature.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay. I'm going to let you continue talking, but I just had like, a huge aha, as you said.
Yeah, no, aha it, because that's,
Well, you know, in my work, I talk a lot about the heroine's journey, and that was a lot of, that was my journey last year in 2016. That was what I went through, and it was unlike anything I'd ever been through before, and I'd never heard of it until I went through it. And I'm grateful that I had it to guide me, because up until then, everything that I knew was the hero's journey, which is exactly the masculine kind of approach that you've just described. It's very singular and it's very linear. The heroine's journey and the spiritual journey of it is, it's like every time this is why I was having such a hard time writing a book about it. Because every time I try to sit down and write about it, I'm like, there's no clear path. Like, there's so many different things all happening.
All the things right now.
At the same time. All of them happening at the same time. Yes. And it's the same anytime I've spoken to a client who is going through it, or like they can sense that it's calling them. And I try and kind of explain it to them. And I feel like, does this make sense? Because it didn't even make sense when I was in it, you know? And what I know, like some features that I know about that journey is that it's cyclical. It's not linear. It's very flowy, and one thing will then lead you into something else, which is completely unrelated and yet totally related. What else? The energy of it is very, it's very internal and therefore kind of in the dark, like the work in the dark. And the metaphors or the images that were coming to me while I was going through it was kind of like the caterpillar in the chrysalis, or the child in the womb, or in the birth canal, where a lot of magic is happening, but if you're looking from the outside, you don't know what it is. And if you're from the inside, you can't explain it to someone who's on the outside anyway, because you have no reference point, right? And so the writings and the stories that I have been really drawn to, and what I'm seeing that my book will be, the form of it, the energy of it, is poetic. It is very flowy. And I think that's why I'm really attracted to your work, because you are a storyteller, and you're a poet as well, and you use storytelling in your work to heal. That is what I'm seeing, that you that you're using storytelling as a way to create space for healing. And What I believe about words is that they really do have this magical quality. And so I'd love for you to speak about that, like stories and how being able to create our own meanings and tell our own stories really does bring healing.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. And then I realized I had a realization yesterday that I wanted to talk to you about, and this is the right time to talk about it. So I realized too that we were talking about this poetry and this, like, I did not expect to be a poet. All of the words coming in my brain at once. Hold on. I get really excited and then they just log jam in there, and then I have to like take a step back and like pull it all apart.
One at a time, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to say the thing that I discovered first, and then I'll backtrack about like, So what I realized yesterday is that what I love about poetry is that I can start right in the middle.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't have to provide any backstory or context. I don't have to cite sources or references. It's a different, I don't have to prove anything.
No.
Like there's no, like with an essay, like there's definitely use for critical essay. Yes to that form of writing as well. But for me, I have felt so much of my life trying to justify or like smooth out before I talk, or to be like, well, this is why I feel that way, or give all this other stuff. Whereas with poetry,
context
and proof, right? Like, right. I deserve to feel this way. Like, here is my well-reasoned argument,
right,
so that I feel this way, right? And with poetry, like, I can skip all over that and just go straight to my feeling is a true feeling, and write from that place of this is what's true for me right now, mm-hmm. without having to contextualize it or apologize it or ask for permission for it or prove to you that I get to feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you, the whatever, not you specifically. Mm-hmm. And that was just like a huge relief to me, because that's what I was saying before. Like, I never expected to be a poet. I didn't, to me, poetry was like very regimented and very structured. You know, the classical poets that I studied, you know, in English class. But there was a benefit to studying that, because it helped me, like, I did not realize it when I was 15, but explicating poetry and figuring out the meaning of words and like what this refers to and how these things are connected, and this is happening over there and that's related to this thing over here, and that's related to this other poem that was written by this other person, or this is circle event, like all of that. That's how my brain works.
Yes.
So I was training my brain in a thought process, even though 15-year-old me just thought it was stupid. But I thought poetry was hard. I thought poetry was structured. I thought poetry was stupid. I thought poetry was like angsty teenage drama. I thought poetry didn't make sense. I thought poetry was verbose. I didn't think I was a writer.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't think I was a writer at all, because like I didn't grow up writing, right? Like the traditional story of the famous writer is, oh, I filled notebook after notebook and all I ever wanted to do was write. All I ever wanted to do was read or act out stories.
Right.
And I don't have a flair for fiction.
Me neither.
Like I couldn't.
I don't have the patience for it either.
Yeah, my brain just isn't worked. Well, like I want to read all the fiction.
Yeah.
And I think I am who I am because I read all of the fiction growing up. Like I was an only child of divorced parents. You know, my mom worked, and so like, and I just read all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my daughter was like, were you bored? Because she has a sibling and I don't. And I was like, no, never. I mean, I probably was, because kids get bored. But like, so I just don't, I don't do long form. I don't do fiction. So I just didn't think I was a writer. But then I was like, oh, wait, if I write about what's really going on with me, and I don't have to give any context, and I can just start from where I write, right where I am. That's where my voice was.
Yeah.
And anybody I told, once I was like, oh my gosh, I'm a writer. Yeah. Everyone I told, they were like, duh, welcome to the party. Where have you been? And I was like, no way. And they're like, yeah, hello.
Like, that was me.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of us writers, we that is really familiar, because exactly what you've just said, like not all of us grew up knowing that we wanted to be writers. Like I was listening to an interview with Cheryl Strayed today, and she was like, yeah, ever since I was a kid, I knew. And I was like, no, ever since I was a kid, I loved reading. Like I loved reading, and I wrote, but I didn't know I could be a writer, or that's something I could ever, you know, aspire to. And we have this idea of what writers are. Like, for me, it was like, well, I can't call, I was writing articles for magazines. I was like, well, I can't call myself a writer because I've never written a book, published a book. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I remember a friend who's a writer said to me, but you write. I was like, yeah, I do. And she's like, you're a writer.
Yeah.
You know, but it always takes us longer to catch up with what everyone else seems to have realized.
Right, which is why we need each other.
Yeah.
Which is why we need that witness. You know what is interesting to me about too, like how I got here was, so like I was a theater major and I was an educational theater major and then I was a teacher and then I was a photographer and all of those things required other people to say yes to me in order to be able to do that. You know, if you want to be an actor, you have to, I mean, there are ways of doing it by yourself, but like you need a theater, like even if you're doing a one woman show, right? Like right. You need a theater to
say yes. Okay.
To say yes, or, you know, a venue to say yes, of any kind of creative venue. And then you need people to say yes to come see you because right. you know, and with photography, like the kind of storytelling photography that I needed, that I wanted to do, it wasn't street photography. It was, telling family stories through photography. So I needed the family to say yes to me. And I just got so tired of waiting or of trying to convince people to say yes to me with all like that marketing or like auditioning. Like I just, I just didn't want to do it anymore. Where with writing, I don't have to wait for anybody. And I don't even look like, you know, they say like writers are writers because they write every day. I don't even actually write every day. Like what I do is when I feel that thing that comes up that says, these words aren't your words. These words are like you say, like these are important channeled words. These are writing words.
Right. Better get that down.
Yeah. You better get it down.
Yeah.
And it's actually on my phone.
Me too. I saw that you posted today. Yeah. You use your notes app. I write everything in my notes app.
So it's like, because it tricks my brain into like, yes. There's nothing serious going on here.
Right.
I'm just texting myself. Right. Like there's like, it tricks like the animal part in my brain. Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
Nothing to see here. You can just don't need to freak out. Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
And it allows me to take it seriously enough to capture it, but not seriously enough that I get in my own way.
Yes.
And I know that I can edit it and it's small, right? Yeah. It's not, I actually like the size of paper for the thing that I'm working on.
Yes.
Like my planner is big because I have all of these things that like to catch everything that's in my head. But like, I want that little tiny screen. It's like a little, it's just over here.
Well, I love this confession so much because like, I think that again, like I think if I was, someone who like I don't do the same, like I was like an aspiring writer or someone who's like waiting for that inner realization that I'm a writer, I used to believe that writers were writers if they wrote every day, mm-hmm. and if they wrote at their laptops, like they had like writing hours and they sat down and they like committed to x number of words per day or x number of hours per day, and that got in my way for so long. Mm-hmm. And ever since I write exactly in the way that you say, I write everything in my notes app basically, and it's because if I sit down in my laptop to work, it feels too important.
This is official. Be smart.
It feels, and so I don't have access then to the part which is channeled anymore. Mm-hmm. It really comes through my ego, through my brain, through trying to make it really logical. And then I don't feel connected to my writing. If I don't feel connected, then nobody else who's reading it is going to feel connected, right? And so again, this is going back to being a wild mystic woman and kind of making our own rules. It's about, if that's the best way you work, then that's how you should do it. And I know for so much of parenting, which I'd love to get onto, yes. Writing, entrepreneurship, everything, there are these ideas of how things are supposed to be. And when we try and jam ourselves into them, it just is very frustrating. And I am constantly questioning myself, like, really, does it have to be that way? Or could you just, you know, just do it the way you've done it, you know? Yeah. And it's just so interesting where these kind of rules come from. And when we start questioning them, realizing it, when I question them and when I go with my own flow, things just move a lot more easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I would love to speak about parenting, because you bring, your work is that you bring storytelling into parenting, and you have this beautiful movement and this community called Parenting Out Loud. Tell me what that's about. Why Parenting Out Loud, and why storytelling? Why is that so important?
Oh, okay. So for me, I was the first person I knew to have a kid. And then we moved across the country to a place where I didn't know anybody. So I had no idea what it was really like. I had no friends to talk to about what that experience is really like. All I had were, you know, movies and TV and sort of this cultural narrative of this idealized motherhood.
Yeah.
And I was a really good student. I wasn't the best. My best friend from high school is valedictorian, and she always got all the A's.
That was me.
Yes. I made cum laude, but I was like 43 out of 44 kids, right? Like, but like, I was a good rule follower, right? Mm. Like, here were the instructions. I would do the instructions.
Yeah.
And so parenthood, and I was a teacher beforehand. I love playing with other people's kids. I loved being around kids. So I thought, okay, well, I'm good at following instructions, and I love being around other people's kids.
I can't what even could go wrong? Street.
I can't even say it on the street. I can't even. Right. And so the shit hit the fan, like, immediately. Because I thought there was a thing, right? If I did X, Y, and Z, that, you know, I could get this stuff in return, right?
Mm.
And, you know, I could get my kid to sleep. Ain't nothing doing. If that kid ain't sleeping, that kid ain't sleeping.
Right.
And you could do, like, all, you know, jump up and down on one foot, spin around, spit, you know, make sacrifice. It's not happening.
No. I'm laughing because my kids are just those kids who don't sleep. Like, they just, yeah. And I look at, like, my brother has a son, and he was sleeping from very early on in his own room. And I'm like, no.
Yeah. So I carried all of this weight of that external expectation. And I didn't enter into the parenthood from the place of deep longing for motherhood. We did it because it was next, right? Like, and I just sort of went along, which is not to say I don't love my children, like, right? Because we all know that.
Yeah. And it's so funny that we always feel like we need to make that really, really clear.
Right.
I see myself doing it when I talk about how, like, you know, I'm an introvert and a parent, and it's,
me too.
Yeah. And so it's like, look, this is like, it was next, you know, or, you know, there is a huge part that wanted them, but also knowing like, it's not my, I've always said like, I'm not a natural mother. I'm just not, you know?
Yeah. So that's why story then is so important to me, because the only stories that I had to hold myself up against, compare myself to, were these external stories, mm-hmm. Of what I thought that looked like, and that rule following thing of trying to then be like that. That's what I thought I was supposed to do. That's what I thought was good and motherly and right. And I had postpartum anxiety, which I didn't even know was a thing. I was like, well, I don't have PPD, postpartum depression. I'm not depressed. I'm terrified. Right? Like, and I, you know, I didn't fully, at that point, I was culturally now, I guess, young. I was 28. I hadn't done a lot of my own growing up, so I didn't have my own grounded sense of who I was. So I was looking externally for those things. And I had a lot of unhealed stuff that I thought I had healed with my father. But, you know, I always say my daughter came out perfectly designed to say, oh, you thought all of those things were healed? Well, I am designed to just go poke, 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 poke. In all of those.
I really resonate with that. Yes. Yeah. It's amazing, and, right? How Yeah.
So I think that's why we need this story, is because as we start to access our own story, we develop key resources that we need to challenge that dominant narrative. That's really the heart of it for me, is the more I have come, even with writing, with parenthood, all of these, marriage, womanhood, and saying this is my story. This is what's true for me. This is my reality. This is my lived experience. These are my values. These are my commitments.
Yeah.
The more I am conscious of what those are, and I'm choosing them in a conscious way, as opposed to working from limiting beliefs and old patterns, the more able I am to stand on my feet and be able to do that flow. Because, as you know, what worked this morning isn't going to work in 30 minutes.
No.
It's not even that what worked this morning isn't going to work tonight. It's not even going to work like 3 seconds from now.
Yeah.
That I had to learn how to be in that flow, seeing them, being with myself, and acting from that grounded place of what do I want to need at this moment? What do they want to need? What are they asking of me? What do I need? And all that other stuff is noise. And now I know, and I'm 11 and a half years into it. So it's just starting to make sense to me. Actually, the process of writing my book last year helped me see that, like, there is no perfection.
No.
I'm going to make mistakes. And that doesn't let me off the hook from trying to be in alignment with that. But my commitment is to this foundation that we have together, where my commitment is so that they know I love them and see them for who they are, to the best of my ability, to see them from themselves without my filter. And not perfect at this. this is not a statement of like, and I know this, so I do it all the time and la-di-da-di-da, look at me. But this is the thing that this is the practice, right? This is the spiritual practice for me of doing this moment to moment to moment, and that navigating how those change from second to second.
Yeah.
You know, 1 minute the kid needs me to be strict, a disciplinarian. No, do not. And then I see her shift and I go, oh, okay, come here, sit on my lap.
Right.
And all the parenting books say that's not okay.
Right.
But I know that kid needs me.
Right.
In a different way than she needed me to be 3 seconds ago. So
I love this. And I love that when you're speaking about parenting out loud, you talk about kind of the opposite of that, which is this culture of silence around parenting. And you say, I'm just kind of reading off of your website, but you say, you know, this culture of silence affects us all differently, but make no mistake, it does affect us all. And you give some examples. You say it expects mothers to be perfect, to be selfless, to perform for others. It expects fathers to be the man, to be stupid and incapable of child rearing, right? We always hear about fathers babysitting the kids and all that kind of talk. You talk about how it expects single parents to perform all roles flawlessly without acknowledgement, recognition, or support. Mm-hmm. Unaware that each role is actually impossible by itself, let alone when resting on the shoulders of one person. It expects those who are child-free by choice or by fate to feel less than, defective, or wrong. As if parenthood is the one and only achievement of a life. It expects birth parents in both open and closed adoptions to forget their claim to parenthood and completely disappear. It expects those whose children have left the nest to disappear. It says your job is over, you don't matter anymore. And it expects our children to be objects of perfection, objects of obsession, objects of our unlived hopes and dreams. They carry the burden of all the ways we stay silent. And I read that and I was like, whoa, yes. Oh my God. It's a lot. And we are living it every single day. And I know, you know, I can speak from my experiences as a mother and a daughter, right? Like there's the two sides of it. Like as a mother, I can really feel that kind of guilt around when I'm away or not performing those roles in the way that, you know, this culture tells us we should perform our roles. And then there's the other side of growing up as a daughter and kind of feeling the pressure of being, you know, perfect as well, being the good girl, and how it really is. And, you know, whether or not you have children, or however the children came into your life, it really does affect us. And I can see how it's so important for all of us to be able to tell all of our stories, mm-hmm. so that, you know, okay, I'm kind of in a, what would you say, like a normalized, you know, I have like, I'm a straight woman, I'm married to my husband, we have two kids, a girl and a boy, you know, right? And so, you know, my experience looks different to those who are single mothers or single parents, for example, or those who choose not to have children. And yet all of our stories matter. And it all brings wholeness. So I can imagine that, I mean, tell me about the community. I can imagine that it's quite a diverse place and that there are all kinds of stories, and yet hearing those stories, even if they're not like your own, is very healing.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I think like we were saying before about like the feminine story, is that there are this multiplicity of voices, and that from all of these unique individual stories, these universal through lines come through. So everybody's daily experience is different, but there's also, you know, there's we are in, I just wrote this about this in the poem the other day, like we are entirely unique and we've never had this experience and this is the only experience and that is the miracle. Hmm. We are entirely human and part of this human condition and this universality, one of many stories told many, many times. And that is the miracle. And it is both those things at the same time.
Yeah. Wow.
So the community is interesting. The way it's structured is that people join the community in waves, and that each incoming group goes through the same series of questions. So they all have had this same shared experience. But of course, every time they're really big questions, everybody was like, okay, Mickey, I'll just write a book here.
Can you give us an example?
like what have you learned? Like, what have you learned about yourself and your life through your parenthood path? And that's what I call it. Even if you don't have your own children at home, that expectation of parenthood does touch all of us in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, what have you learned? And so the last group that I did was actually really interesting. It was myself. And I love doing these questions at that level, because I work through it and answer it too every time. And because they're that size, my job as a leader is to ask the question and hold the space.
Yes.
It's not to have the answers. It's not to be perfect. So it allows me to be a participant and facilitator at the same time. Mm. The Christina Baldwin's Circle Way work has just been hugely influential on how I think about that kind of structure. And so this last time we did it, it was me and three other women. One does not have children of her own, and then the other two were empty nesters. Mm-hmm. And I was the youngest one in the group. I was the only one, and I was the only one with kids still at home.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really fascinating, because I wrote these questions in response to stories I wish I could have told.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting to see how, I'm going to be 40, and then there are other women in the group who are 59, right? And so how they interacted and responded to the questions is different from how I interacted and responded to the questions. And it was really interesting to see how the story held us both. Mm. And my own ego had a little moment of oh my gosh, they don't like me. They don't resonate with this question. What do I do? And then I go that's fine. They don't have to I don't want them to answer it the way I would answer it. I want to know what this question brings up in everybody. And so it was a really interesting interplay of the women who were older were saying I can't just separate parenthood out.
Right.
Because they're so many parts of my life that I've learned things from. Whereas for me, I'm still very much in the thick of it. And so much of my personal growth has come as a result of becoming a mother, that I, at this phase at least, and I don't know what it'll be like when I'm 59, but at this phase at least, I can't separate out the two. Mm-hmm. But it was really cool hearing that other people can, and that, the woman who doesn't have kids was saying that's decision, I made it for these reasons. And then once I made that decision, yes, the dominant culture wanted to tell me certain things about that decision, but I didn't care, And so it's really interesting. It's really cool. And it's also cool to see how it evolved. Because at first I thought the questions were prompts to create art. I thought they were writing prompts.
Mm.
And then I very quickly realized in the first run through of it that that the expectation that people would create art from this, even if I said it doesn't have to be good art, still created a thing, an energy that made it hard for people to respond. Because even if you say the art doesn't have to be good, of course we're going to try, right? And it kept me from responding. I felt like I had to write poetry every time with the question.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I want us to just be able to be together with what's true right now. And wherever this question takes you is what I want to hear, is what mm-hmm. we need to hear right now. And so very quickly, I realized that they were story prompts, not writing prompts, not art prompts. And if some people wanted to make art as a result, that was perfectly acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But that it was the story of, this is what's true for me right now, this is where I am with this question, that was where the real magic was and the real connection and the real presence was, not trying to make something from it. Because that's how I process the world, but I can't do that on cue always. And it's not how everybody else processes the world. And there was a layer of expectation on it that I didn't want. I just wanted us to be together.
So what does story do, Mickey? Like, why is it like, I mean, I think about experiences that I've had and I kind of use, you know, that I share a lot on social media. And I do, like I said, I write a lot of my writing on the notes app. And a lot of it is just sharing my experiences. And what I found for myself is that if I'm feeling uncomfortable around something, or just kind of like, I don't feel like I'm really holding my power here, or something has kind of triggered me. What I used to do was kind of go inwards in myself and really sit with it, and it would chew me up and it would, would really do a number on me. And now my kind of immediate response is, let me write it. Mm. And as I write it, in the writing, I find something.
Yeah.
And by the time I've gotten to the end of it, I've figured out like how I feel, what I want to do about it, what it means to me. So that's one part, and that's huge, and sharing it so that it can be witnessed takes it to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you have these one-on-one witnessing sessions that you do. Mm-hmm. Right, where you're allowing people to basically come and be heard. What is it in that just is so, I don't know, it's just magical. It's just like there's something about owning your story and having it witnessed by others that just does something important.
Yeah, I think it has to do with this concept of okayness, which it's not goodness, right? It's not bad. It is what is. And I think there is so much pressure on us to not be with what is.
Mm-hmm.
Because that keeps us off balance, and then that means we look outside ourselves for leadership and buying things.
Yeah.
And when we have an opportunity to be with what is, just that space opens up, because it's not, we don't need, you know, and I think there's a lot of dangerous positivity in our culture that wants to, you know, that says if we are thinking about things, bad things, we're bringing bad things into our life, right? Like, I don't want to manifest bad things, so I'm not going to think about bad things.
Right.
But that cuts off this piece of us that, in that in some moments is hurting. And to say it shouldn't makes it even more damaging.
Right.
Like, so not only does it hurt, but then it shouldn't hurt, so that hurts more. I mean, I have anxiety, and sometimes I'm able to say, all right, look at this instead. But sometimes the only way
I can process that is to say, I am not okay right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to just stop trying to be positive and stop trying to feel good. And so we just, it is what it is. That's not my story to share. But we get lots of messages to say like, it shouldn't be this way. You shouldn't have to do this thing. Except that these things in our life are monumental. Like this shift from being any spiritual journey, like you were talking about what you went through last year, like it's a transformation. Part of you is dying. The woman you were,
yes.
You are no longer the woman you were, and you are not yet the woman you are becoming.
Right.
That is a process that takes the time it takes, that feels the way it feels, and can't be shoulded all over. Mm-hmm. You know, you should rush through this. Can't. You should feel happy right now. Can't. And to say that you should be when you're not, I just think that's really, I really feel like that's violent.
Yes, I agree.
And unjust.
Yeah.
And so when somebody comes to me and says, this is what I'm going through, this is what's true for me, that's the part that we start from there.
Mm.
We, you know, I was talking to my best friend, she's like, you're so good at this. And I've known her since we were 12. So I kind of can cheat with her because I have lots of reference material to pull from, I don't assume that she shouldn't feel the way she is feeling. I take that as true in this moment for her.
Yeah.
And so I'm not trying to get anybody to feel different. It's really just acknowledging, yeah, that's, and we don't get that acknowledged. I mean, look at all of these. I feel like that's so much of what intersectionality is, right? The ask of intersectionality is, please believe my lived experience.
Right.
I am telling you, this is how it is for me.
Mm.
Please believe that it is true.
Right.
And we see the damage that is being done across so many of our populations. Every population that isn't seen for who they are, isn't believed that their lived experience is true for them, and that's invalidated, that I can't abide that. Like, I'm gonna cry. Like, we need to care for that.
Yeah.
That is one of the many ways that we are going to be able to move forward. And again, like, that's the other thing too. Like, I think the way we move forward from what's going on in the world is we collectively, it's again, that multiplicity of voices. No single one of us is holding the answer, I will go on record of drawing the line of saying, like, this is categorically true. We have to believe.
Yeah.
Other people when they say, this is true for me.
Yeah, and that's true whether we're talking about social justice, mm-hmm. or, just like a friend in our life, a person, mm-hmm. in our community.
Mm-hmm. Or our children, right? Our children, like, we're so, I struggle with this all the time. My kid's upset. That's not anything to be upset about, except the kid is really upset.
Right.
Right? Like, that's real for them. So, yeah.
Well said, Nikki. Thank you. Can I tell you what cards I pulled for you?
Dude, I'm so excited. Like, this this is like, I've been wanting, I was like, I want me some Layla magic.
It's so funny because I'm like, we could just talk without the cards. Like, everything you're saying is magic already.
No, but like, I want to hear, like, you have a connection to the things, and I'm so excited to hear.
Oh, well, I'm really excited. So, for everyone who's listening, I chose the Sacred Rebels deck by Alana Fairchild for Mikki. And this deck is, I love this deck. I use it a lot when I'm stuck creatively in my work, or even just in my life, where it comes to, like, when I'm out of alignment, Like, what's missing here? What am I not connecting to?
I love that rebellion is the answer to that.
Yes.
That makes me so exciting.
Yes. And so the three cards that I pulled for Mickey, like, I've literally never seen these cards before. And I use this deck, you know, it's, you know, I love this deck. But each card that came up, never seen it before, and each one is perfect. So the first one is called In the World, Not of the World. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I read the kind of blurb in the book about what is this card about? And this card is actually about letting go of conditioning that we've been given in our lives that is no longer serving us. Mm. And I was like, yep, okay. Mm. The second card is called The Perfection of Your Life. Mm. And this card was talking about how even when it seems that you are in a storm, when you're inside the storm, it looks really, really chaotic. But if you're above the storm, it's actually very beautiful. Mm. And how there's a lot going on, and yet there is always a kind of thread of perfection. And then the last one I really loved, it's called Collaborative Dreaming. Yes, which I think is really you. Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's talking about how if we want to be making a change in the world, we can't be doing it alone, and we need to collaborate with other creative souls in our communities. So those are the three cards: In the World, Not of the World, The Perfection of Your Life, and Collaborative Dreaming. So wherever, whatever comes up, I'm gonna allow you to just riff on that.
So what came up for me was that perfection of your life, that the moment that came up for me was, actually I haven't talked to many people about this, so I'm excited. So it's a blessing to share it with you. I watch the election and I couldn't. Yeah. I like shut down. I was getting. I just was
It's hard now to find the words, isn't it? When it comes to the U.S. election.
Yeah, I felt all of the weight of that and the ramifications of our choice, and I couldn't. I felt the pain of that. And the anger in it, and I actually became, I could see it starting to affect my kids. They started to fight because I could see like my behavior was leaking. And so I actually had to like get that under, you know, to know like we are the people who build, we are the people who create. Mm. And so that's what I, you know, I went up and I said to them, and I said, you know, this is a lot right now. But this is who we are, even though I really wanted to fix it. So the opposite of collaborative dreaming was like, I will fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Me. And then my wise friend Harmony was like, and you don't get to be the white savior lady. And I was like, but I want to, and I couldn't fix it with my dad, and I want to fix it now.
Right.
Well, we can't. And so I didn't sleep last night. And the next day, I was supposed to get on a plane to go to New York, and my husband was already in New York. So I was like alone in my house. I didn't sleep. I woke up the next morning and I got on this plane, and it was just so surreal. Like the world, it was not the same world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I got off the plane in Newark, and people were talking to each other. That like there was a group of people talking about it in front of me, and they were like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting out of your way. And I was like, no, actually, like I hear you and I'm with you. And these complete strangers in New York, where nobody talks to strangers, talked to me, and like we walked to the baggage carousel together. And then like I took the train in, and I took the escalator, and then all of a sudden there I was in New York, and 8 million people had gotten up the next day and gone to work and lived their lives and showed up.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful to see these souls together living in the world and being. And so that's that perfection of your life, right? Like,
yeah,
we have a lot of work to do. And 8 million beautiful people got up the next day. I mean, we were talking to busboys and we were talking to people on the subway. I mean, we were just like, there was a, we held each other in the midst of this huge thing that we now have to, that we no longer have the privilege of ignoring, even though people have been asking us to look at it for ages.
Right. The kind of everything that was bubbling underneath and that's always been there and never been healed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was such an intense experience of being simultaneously brokenhearted and deeply in love with humanity at the same time. And it was so, it was a very strange duality because I felt both 100%.
Right.
And I think that's a miracle of being human, right? Like it's, it is supremely damaged and supremely divine at the same time. And then we collectively dream together. And what was the first one?
and in the world, not of the world.
Right.
Yeah, right. Which is about, you know, we don't have to be basically constrained by the conditions of what society tells us this is how you're supposed to be, this is how you're supposed to live your life and parent and everything else.
Yeah. I mean, I just had that kind of, that's how I, my upbringing was that. Like, my mom's a hippie. I grew up in Hawaii. So that's just a place that's different from the rest of the world. Like, right. It's the, I knew growing up there that that we were of the land wasn't ours. We, you know, that, and you could see the pain that having that land taken away from the people it belonged to, like that's present daily.
Yeah.
And then my mom started to go to a meditation ashram when I was 8. So I've grown up in an Eastern philosophical tradition. And so there's just my whole, there's like a set of the world and then there's like, but I had this whole other upbringing that makes me see those things differently.
And it's so interesting because, and yet the culture of silence and the very oppressive systems that exist still affect all of us.
Yeah.
And is so so far reaching and so just really ingrained. And I know a lot of your work and what you talk about, I mean, is about parenting and storytelling, but it's also about this collective healing and this social activism as well. Because I mean, my whole thing around it is like, and I think, I don't know, I feel like maybe this is similar for you, but I feel like I can only do what I can do, right?
Yeah,
and it's,
yeah.
And it's,
I want to do more.
But I want to do more. And the best way that I can help is to be really good at doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And really using it as a way to go deeper and further. And so that means, that has meant, I remember like the day of the election, and you know, I've said this several times, like I don't live in the US, and so I'm not a US citizen. And yet I remember waking up in the morning and reading the election results and crying, like properly crying. And I was so surprised, like where this came from. And then I remember a feeling of like, do you remember floppy disks? Right? When you would like get a new floppy disk, you would reformat it where you would like wipe it clean completely. That was like a physical feeling that happened inside of me, where I felt like every fear and self-doubt and petty kind of like silly, small belief about myself and my ability to do anything kind of got wiped clean that day. Because I was like, this is no longer about you. This is no longer about you. The world is entering into a different phase. And you need to get up to speed because there is work to be done and each of us has to do it and you have to do your part.
I think that's a lot of the growth pains we're feeling, is that we're all being called to do the thing we most, to like really tend our plot of land.
Right.
And that that requires us to a clear-sightedness that asks us to look at a lot of stuff that we would rather not have to see.
Yes.
I mean, I had that same feeling of like my anxiety pattern is like, you're not good enough.
Right.
And you can't, you know, you anxiety, oh, you're not good enough. And then I was like, I don't have the luxury of believing that anymore. And I don't have the luxury of wondering if I should be writing or sharing or saying, like, I don't have the luxury. Like, I actually was like, if you don't write, then he wins.
Right.
Well, that's a really good way of getting over resistance, right? It's like, if I say that I'm for just social justice, and I mean, I get that makes it all, I know it's not all about me, right? But right. Like, we have to serve in the ways that we are, have been designed and have been studying our whole lives to serve and to speak up in the lanes that we have to speak up. Like, I mean, I'm going to briefly over this story because I don't, it's not about me being ally cookies, but a moment came up when I was at an art museum and there was a moment where there was a white docent and there were people of color in the thing. And there was a question about representation of people of color in these artworks and how people are like artistic representation and the field of art, like, that's my lane. Like,
right.
I've been studying that my whole life. So I had like, I don't know about election fraud. I don't know about gerrymandering. There's a lot of problems that I don't know about.
Right.
So that I don't, and I'm finding the places where I can build on the knowledge I already have so that I don't have to reinvent the wheel. And there's good work already being done. Like, it's not, I don't have to solve it. There are other people who are already doing the work.
Right.
That I can help amplify. Right.
My activism doesn't have to look like her activism.
Right. Kind of thing. But in that moment, that was my lane.
Mm.
Like, and I had to say something in that moment to that docent and then call the museum later because I knew I could speak with authority on that subject and that the people that it was unlikely that anybody, that the people of color whose voices weren't being heard in that moment were going to call. And that that was my lane. I had to tend that garden.
Right. Right. And that's it, right? That's it. It's like our activism has to be in our lane. Like, what is your area where, because it's like I said, like the problems, the oppression is widespread, far-reaching, ingrained in all areas of life. So you have to look, what am I good at? What am I passionate about? What do I have expertise in? And where can I speak up? And where can I start making a difference? And, you know, whether it's like, when I look at your work in this the Parenting Out Loud community, you know, that's just as much activism as what you just described, the situation that you've just described there in the in that story. And so, thank you. You know, it has to be, I think we have to be really careful about not getting overwhelmed and not thinking that every part of our work matters. And we have to look at what our offers are, you know, we have to look at, like, what am I actually putting out there into the world? And is there a way that I could, just make them, make sure that I'm not kind of just serving one community, or, you know, that there is intersectionality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. The parenting journey, like even the language that I used to talk about it, because I actually, this has been an idea I've been kicking around actually since 2012, my Facebook memories are popping up that I was doing some thinking in this area back then. Mm-hmm. But it was very specifically targeted to motherhood, and it was definitely, you know, cisgendered motherhood.
Right.
And it was probably married motherhood too.
Right.
And my thinking has evolved to, it's very, very, very explicitly parenting and not motherhood, for that reason, because, like, I see how it affects my husband differently than it affects me.
Right.
For sure. The expectations on us are different, but we each carry that weight and are grappling with what the meanings of this, and becoming a father changed him.
Yeah.
You know? And I had actually left out, I didn't think about it at first, but a friend reminded me about birth parents. Too, like that's a specific story too of family of giving, you know, however that comes to pass, that they're given their child to adoption. That's still part of this story of parenthood, and the people who are child free by choice or by fate, who wanted but couldn't or never wanted, this is all part of this super swimming in, and it's all part of this story. So it is very intentionally parenthood. And it is as opposed to motherhood, for that reason, because how we do, you know, how we do one thing, in some ways how we do one thing is how we do everything, and raising the next generation. And that's everybody is involved in raising the next generation. It takes a village, right? So it takes the child-free aunts. It takes women choosing to art or needing to, whatever, how that comes to pass, giving their children into adoption so that other families can have, you know, we are all this village. And all of those stories are necessary to do this. And we are collectively creating the stories that will be embodied and imbibed by the next generation. And I think we feel the pain of our parents' generation not being conscious of that. I think that is one of the struggles of parenthood, is we know how early, we now know the psychological impacts things can have. And so that actually caused me a lot of damage, because I was like, everything I do is going to mess up this child.
Yeah.
And so you have to get how you navigate that, you right. know, and then it, and that's where I had to come to, like, the foundation was more important than the moment. Like, the kids, it is generational, that each generation comes of age and then has to look at what they inherited,
yes.
and decided what they're going to keep and what they're going to let go. That is part of the coming of age process. There's nothing I can do to protect from the pain of that. That is a necessary part of becoming an adult.
Yes.
But what I can do is to be as aware as possible of seeing my actual kid for who they actually are. Are each one of them differently than the other, and being very aware of the language and the stories that I tell them about my life and my and the world and what I reflect back to them.
Yeah.
Because we all know that those voices in our heads, we hear our parents' voices.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so we are doing the work of healing the world when we look at our own personal stories, when we come into an honest relationship with them. We are doing social justice work, and we are doing the work of allowing more and more freedom, creating more and more space and freedom for those who come after us.
Absolutely.
No pressure, though.
No pressure, you guys. It's fine. We're just raising the next generation of, you know.
Right.
It's fine.
So this is
fine.
Right. This isn't to say freak the fuck out because, oh my God, we're all going to die. This is to say you are already doing in your daily life, the work of your daily life, what you are already doing, doing that. Your commitment to doing that.
Yeah.
From your highest self. That is already the work of healing and social justice. So it was meant to be it's okay. You're already taking care of it. Not freak out. But my husband and I do joke. We'll look at each other and we'll just go, ka-ching. We're just like, there's the next therapist bill for the kids.
It's fine. Oh, they're going to be screwed up. It's fine. I love what you've said there, because my husband and I have that conversation as well about how there's going to be things that we do just because that's what happens, is that, you know, that like there's going to be things that we do and how we raise them that are going to affect them in not so great ways, and they're going to have to work through that. But what is important to both my husband and I is that our kids grow up knowing they can always come and speak to us, that we accept them as they are, and then we support them. And having that foundation requires doing a lot of inner like self-acceptance work. It's not simple, but it's, you know, the vision that we hold for our family. Mickey, thank you so much for this incredible conversation. I could speak to you for a long time more.
Like, let's stay up all night.
But I know we have come to the end of our time together. I would love for you to share where people can find you, how they can work with you, about your book, where they can find that. Could you share that, please?
Oh, yes. My website is mickeydevivo.com. Mm-hmm. You want me to spell that?
No, we'll just write it down. In the show notes. We'll
just put it down. Yeah. Yay, the fun of all of the various ethnicities of my name. And all of the pieces of that are there. I'm actually putting, hopefully by the time this goes out there will be a way to sign up for a no cost personal stories piece of this work of getting a question every day for 14 days, and then we're going to start monthly story calls.
Amazing.
So I'm working on that, and then there's the information about the witnessing sessions and Parenting Out Loud are in the menu bar of that. And then my book is called and it's on Amazon, but the best way to find it is through my name, not the number, because it is the number 38.
Yeah.
But if you put that into Amazon, you'll get a bunch of like size 38 bras, and that's not what you're looking for. So the best way to find it is through my name.
I'll definitely make sure to link to the Amazon page as well for that in the show notes.
And then I'm Mickey DeVivo on Instagram and on Facebook. And then there's also a Parenting Out Loud page on Facebook. And so I'd love to see everybody and hear everybody, this collective story works when this story is collective, so everybody's voice and story does matter. And so if you're sitting there going, oh, that's great for Layla and Mickey, but not for me. Like, that's not, your story matters and you are welcome all.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, just with everything you've explained today about what this Parenting Out Loud community and this work is around, like, as Mickey said, like, it's, you don't have to be a mother or father, you know, a parent to be affected by, mm-hmm. by this, and to be, you know, like, your story to count in this community. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I really want to encourage people to check out your work, your book. You know, Mickey, you just have this incredible energy, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm so grateful for this conversation, because it just feels like you just tell the truth, and you tell it in this, just this messy kind of in the mess, but like also really like, I feel like I'm listening to you and I'm like, I'm listening to a really sage person who's really like in the mess as well. I just want to thank you for your presence and for everything that you've contributed here today in this conversation. I know I'm walking away feeling, like, I'm going to be looking at how I'm parenting more and more, and, mm-hmm. and my stories around that. And I know I will continue to look to you and be inspired by you as a writer as well. So thank you so much, Mickey.
Yeah, thank you. Compliments are hard, but that was very high praise, and I will accept it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So happy to know.
Yeah, I'm so glad we've
to be continued.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So to our lovely listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation as much as I clearly did, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and YouTube. And if you'd like to receive more Wild Mystic Woman magic through email, head on over to www.wildmysticwoman.com and sign up for the Temple Letters. So until next time, goodbye, sisters.